Welcome to Rooster Radio. I'm Andrew Montesi with James Begley. We've got a couple of episodes live from South Start. South Start is a conference that showcases entrepreneurship and innovation in South Australia, with great speakers, expos and workshops. We kick things off on opening night with a live panel chat with Dr. Alex Grant, which we're sharing with you now. Alex is doing truly amazing things. He is CEO of Myriota, an Internet of Things company which is gaining recognition globally. Before Myriota, he entered the autonomous vehicle market with his company Coda. This was back in 2004, well before the buzz of driverless vehicles. Alex shares amazing tech insights and also his fascinating personal journey. Let's jump into the chat now with MC Luke Howes kicking things off.
So let's get started with our fireside chat. Let's move into that. So the fireside chat tonight is going to be hosted by entrepreneurs themselves who have a podcast called Rooster Radio about entrepreneurship and high performance. It has 5-star rating on the iTunes store and has partnership with InDaily media outlet. So our first rooster is Andrew Montesi, a full-stack marketer, media producer and entrepreneur with a career that's extended across professional services, social enterprise, TV news and sports marketing. With strong foundations in media, public relations and content marketing, Andrew is head of marketing at Pickstar, an online marketplace that is revolutionising access to sporting talent for paid engagements of any kind. Please welcome from Pickstar and Rooster Radio, Andrew Montesi. The other half of Rooster Radio, up the other end of our seating, is James Begley, an entrepreneur and former professional athlete who is the founder and CEO of Pickstar, a marketplace that opens up access to sports stars for any engagement or experience imaginable. So far, Pickstar has facilitated over 500 connections, working with some of the biggest brands, including Westpac, Uber and Deloitte, along with countless charities, schools and clubs. Please welcome CEO of Pickstar and Rooster Radio, James Begley. So our fireside guest tonight is a real treasure to South Australia, I think. He's Dr. Alex Grant, the Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of Myriota Proprietary Limited, which offers global Internet of Things connectivity via satellite. He was previously a professor and director of the Institute for Telecommunications Research at the University of South Australia. In 2004, he co-founded Coda Wireless, the leading supplier of software for the connected autonomous vehicle market. He was also the recipient of the 2013 Piercy Entrepreneur Award, the 2008 Neville Tierley Award from Engineers Australia, and the 2004 Young Tall Poppy Science Award. Please welcome Dr. Alex Grant, CEO of Myriota. Over to the team from Rooster Radio. Thank you.
Thanks very much. It's great to be here. James and I started Rooster Radio a couple of years ago now. Very humble, one microphone, no idea what we're doing. Still really don't know what we're doing, but we're having a crack. Our overall theme really has been to talk to interesting people doing amazing things, ideally with a link to Adelaide. We're always big believers in the fact that there's plenty of hidden gems and great stories out of Adelaide that weren't being told. And our idea was to showcase these stories. And Dr. Alex Grant certainly ticks every single box that Rooster Radio could wish for. So welcome, Alex. Let's kick off with Myriota, one best industrial IoT startup recently at the world's biggest IoT summit in Silicon Valley. What is it about Myriota that is capturing the attention of the world?
Well, it's a big play. We're aiming to offer connectivity that supports a really vibrant and important play on the global stage, Internet of Things. Now, of course, Internet of Things itself is a lightning rod for all kinds of digital transformation these days. And our piece in that is to provide connectivity in areas where it's just not cost effective to do that by other means. So the problem that we've solved is to get little bits of data from anywhere on the world into the cloud so you can get that sense of data and transform your business as a result.
Yeah.
One of the advantages of never having got a science degree is I can ask really stupid questions. And one of them is, you know, can you give us some really tangible, specific examples, I guess, of how the technology is, is changing lives?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, tangible. So, you know, sensor to cloud interfaces. This is just a piece of electronics, but So that's our first generation product that's been deployed in a number of trials in Australia and around the world. One instance of that is a connected water tank. Sounds mundane, it's low-hanging fruit, but it's the difference between, say, employing a jackaroo. It's like painting the Sydney Harbour Bridge. You go around the property, check all the water tanks, you finish doing that, right, keep going, do it again. The consequence of that water not being available to stock is really high. So you have a piece of electronics that interfaces to some sensors, goes over our network of low Earth orbit satellites, which provides a really cost-effective global communications platform to then say, okay, here we are. Here's these two water tanks. These are deployed on the smart farm in Armidale. And in fact, we had our first, I guess, significant event with this particular application where the property manager of that farm came into work, right, there's an alarm, what's going on, pumps failed, tanks empty, go out right there then and there and fix it. And that's really, so that's on a smart farm at a university, but deployed into working properties, which is the next step for that particular instance of the technology, that's, you know, starting to make a difference in actual operational businesses that, you know, really, so reduce cost, reduce risk, but we're more interested in some of the areas where it actually lets you transform a business. So, for example, a company, let's say, that hires out construction equipment. Right now, it's just not cost-effective to get telemetry back from those devices. They're, you know, generators, pumps, lighting towers, all kinds of stuff. Where is it? How long has it been running for? I don't know. Does the client know where it is? Don't know. This is real interaction with customers. Little device like that, right price point service. Now you're not hiring out the thing anymore. You're actually saying, okay, I'm giving you a compressor service by the hour.
Can you tell us, I mean, you were talking before to us about the power and the battery life. Mm. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so why we're getting traction is for a couple of main reasons. So we're offering this at a price point that's really disruptive in the context of the incumbent satellite providers. How do we do that? Very low-cost electronics, very, very low-cost and increasingly commoditized nanosatellites the size of a shoebox, of which there's this amazing growing ecosystem of suppliers that we get to take the benefit of, and then this battery life. So being able to have a technology, and this is really our key thing that we do, the algorithms, the math that let us transmit incredibly weak radio signals from the ground to a shoebox flying in space that's 800 kilometres away, travelling at 7.5 kilometres per second. To make things worse, that shoebox, if it was over Alice Springs, can see all of Australia at once. So it now has to deal with millions of those things talking to it at the same time at tiny, tiny power levels. So they're almost invisible, and they're all just jumbled up on top of each other. Mm. And we solve that problem with some advanced signal processing in the cloud while without breaking the bank on the battery life. Mm.
It's amazing stuff. If you stripped it right back, and I did read somewhere that you were very strong about creating commercial outcomes when you began the business. Did you set upon, you know, trying to form a solution to this farming problem, let's say, or were you more like, let's develop the technology and then see where the commercial aspects lie?
So the history of this project actually goes back to 2010, when we were formulating a proposal into a federal government funding scheme called the Australian Space Research Program. This is when we were at UniSA. And actually we had a consortium of industry partners where this problem of cost-effective remote connectivity for machine-to-machine connectivity, which is what it was called at that time, now we know it as Internet of Things, was really identified. And in fact, step one of that research program was generating user requirements. And this was a really interesting research project for me, because a lot of research, some of my own research included, is that blue sky stuff of not quite sure what this is going to be good for, but this is super interesting. Let's run away with this and see where this goes. Whereas this was much more, I call it sort of intentioned research, where it's like, right, what's the problem? And let's actually solve this, demonstrate the solution, and have a portfolio of IP that emerges from that, that positions us to then commercialise that technology. And then that was the point where we took it forward.
Can you give us some insight about the IoT industry more broadly in terms of where it's at? As a punter with not much of a clue in this space, I mean, we see the consumer products that are starting to emerge, but from your perspective, where's it at?
So I think it's you know, you can talk to a lot of different people, would probably put it at the peak of the hype cycle. There's a lot of expectation around, you know, IoT is going to do XYZ for me. And, you know, I think that's actually true. That expectation is slightly ahead, I think, of some of the enabling technologies. And the whole landscape of IoT from a technology perspective is, I think, yet to settle down. So we've got, you know, upstarts like us saying we're going to provide global IoT via, you know, tiny satellites. You've got other, you know, really exciting startups saying, well, we've got a low-power terrestrial technology and we're going to roll out base stations all over the world and provide access that way. Mm. You've got telcos like, you know, Telstra, Optus, Vodafone here in Australia and, of course, globally, saying, well, we've got 5G. You know, we've already got 4G in your pocket. We've got 5G technologies that are standardising in that same standards framework, technologies that will maybe address this problem. When I've gone to talk to prospective customers, there's actually quite a bit of frustration around, we want to do IoT right now. We know what we want to, you know, we want to decrease our cost of operations by doing predictive maintenance. So we need a solution. Where is it? Mm. And in fact, across the board, you know, ourselves included, we're kind of at the leading edge of availability, sort of feeding into what is a very strong demand for a solution. Mm.
So what do you think will ultimately happen? Will there be some consolidation, some collaboration? What happens next?
It's really interesting to think about that, because there's a number of standards and proprietary systems in, you know, trying to get into the market that are all vying for a place in the market. I think standards will shake out and will dominate. But there's really places for niche players. I mean, you look at the existing telecommunications, you know, landscape now, just phones, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, Zigbee, all these things, each of them fulfill a little piece of the puzzle, and that kind of jigsaw puzzle is being assembled right now. There'll be a few pieces that will drop off the table, go under the carpet. Hopefully we're not one of them, you know, that's yet to settle.
Can you give, I guess, to sort of round out the discussion, you know, for this chapter of your life, but can you give us a broad snapshot, I guess, of where your business is at, without giving away too many trade secrets, but, you know, in terms of some of the commercial aspects, some of the clients and customers that you've got?
So right now, you know, we've got a number of, publicised pilot deployments. The water tank monitoring is one of those. We have another one in oceanographic drifters with the Australian Institute of Marine Science, which is, in fact, our first instance of our SDK being in the hands of a customer and developing applications on our platform. Alongside that, there's a bunch of commercial stuff that's all funneling into building up our internal processes ahead of service launch. So very much focused on bedding down the technology, but not just the technology, also the business processes and all the partnerships being put in place to be selling the service.
To shift to another company that you co-founded, Coda Wireless. Mm. Can you explain Coda's role in bringing autonomous vehicles to life?
So,
in a simple way as possible.
So Coda's an interesting one, right? So founded in 2004, and cast your mind back to 2004, if people talked about self-driving cars, you would just say that's science fiction. And in fact, we would have said the same thing at that point in time. Coda, where Coda has really succeeded is in making the communications between vehicles and between vehicles and infrastructure actually work, and work in safety of life types of applications. So that's one set of applications. So in the context of autonomous vehicles, now we're talking about connected autonomous vehicles. So an autonomous vehicle drives the car the same way that you and I drive a car. It uses light to look at the environment around it, and it uses an electronic brain to figure out what's going on and make decisions and take action. What it can't do is see around corners. If it wants to know the traffic light ahead, what state that's in, it looks at it, does some AI and says, okay, my senses are telling me that's red, better stop. What connectivity adds to that is, well, forget all that, just actually electronically communicate with the traffic light, tells you what state it's in, it tells you what time it's going to change in 6 second time, you can optimize the engine or whatever platoon go through, so you never actually stop all these types of things. So connectivity becomes kind of a extended sensing technology for autonomous vehicles. On top of that, CODA is now getting very much into other types of sensing technology like positioning. So we've all had the problem of GPS thinks I'm here, but I'm actually here. And one of the things that I was intimately involved with at CODA from a technology perspective and that now is looking really exciting is positioning vehicles on the road without needing GPS and extremely accurately.
So just in terms of autonomous vehicles, driverless cars, it's hard to make sense of where it's actually at currently because there is this hype and it's, you know, it's here now or it's 10 years away in terms of being mainstream. I mean, where is it?
That's a really good question. That's one of those ones that's sort of been put, it's coming, and then suddenly it's going to be here, right? So picking when that tipping point is occurring, you know, we've got, I mean, what we do know is every single vehicle OEM has an autonomous program. They're all deploying connectivity solutions into the vehicles. So, you know, this is inevitable, but there's a little bit of a cat and mouse between the technology and the social acceptance, and even just simple things like the legal and regulatory frameworks, insurance, et cetera, actually being at the point where supposing this stuff was all fine, is it okay to go and buy one and use it, right? So there's a lot of issues beyond just the technology, but I mean, it's just headed in a kind of a direction that really indicates this is, you know, this is not science fiction, this is actually happening.
You were, I guess, in the game before it was kind of sexy. I mean, this is like, you know, early to mid-2000s and it was talked about, but not like it is now. Was it ever demoralising, you know, talking to people about this, knowing where it can go, and kind of being rebuffed and sort of sent packing?
So definitely challenging. When CODA got into the vehicle-to-vehicle communication space, there was a particular communication standard based on the same Wi-Fi that's in your phone and laptops, which was basically being repurposed. So car manufacturers said, we'll just use these same chips, we'll put them in cars, everything will be fine. All right, famous last words. Just wasn't going to work. There were trials. You know, US Department of Transport is looking at this going, you know, this is doomed, this is not working, and the whole thing's about to fall flat. And that was the point where the particular problem that was causing that failure mode was exactly the thing that we had the math and the technology to fix. And that's actually really interesting. So that's, you know, that was the point where CODA went from struggling along, trying in a few other markets, to suddenly like, okay, this is what we're doing now, solving really a problem. So that's fine. The next number of years were then just spent clocking up tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of kilometres on the road, driving car execs around in cars fitted out with this stuff, showing it working. Much like autonomous vehicles are having to do now, showing it working to just build up the confidence in the system.
You've got investors in the room tonight. Tomorrow there's going to be hundreds of people sort of who are in this startup space who are requiring investment. How did you fund and how did you give your businesses enough oxygen in the early days to get to a point where you could potentially be commercial?
So the case with Miriota was kind of interesting because the seed funding for Miriota, in a sense, came when we were still inside the university, and that was very conscious. We looked at the $5 million cash that we got, that we were bidding for from this research program, and with my CODA experience, looking at this going, all right, it's irresponsible to do anything else than to treat this like an investment and actually expect a commercial outcome out of this. So that was the starting point. And that, in fact, having the conversation with the university even before the contract was signed of saying, that's how we're viewing this, this is what we're going to do.
Is that unusual for them?
I think so. I think there's much, you know, there's an increasing commercial focus within all kinds of universities, but certainly at that time, You can ask maybe Steve Rotto if he's running around or someone like that. But that's not typical behavior, at least in the time that we did that.
Mm. Mm. Does hype translate into funding?
It can. Absolutely, it can. I mean, you can see all kinds of things being invested in on the back of hype. Our focus, both with Coda and Mariota, has been to play to our strengths, which is technological advantage paired with actual commercial opportunity.
In this journey, if we took a more personal aspect, and you said that there's a moment that it was like a Jerry Maguire moment where it just felt like everything was working, versus a moment where you're a bit demoralised. Can you maybe paint a picture of the two ends of the spectrum?
You definitely go through ups and downs, obviously. The core technology for Mariota almost never came about. The industrial consortium we pulled together was destabilised right at the time that the funding agreement needed to be signed, which was a result of things that are totally out of everyone's hand. There were some corporate takeovers that meant one of the partners wasn't going to be in, and then of course that all destabilised everything. The VC at the time, Peter Hoy, was looking at this and going, this is high risk, I am not signing this. University can't sign this. And it's a story, he still kind of tells people today of the moments like, no, I believe in these guys, we're going to go for this and we're going to take the risk. And that was one of these ones where we'd actually bid into this program a number of times and just had the thing almost fall apart so many times. And then to be, victory snatched from you at the point of where you could kind of see, okay, here we're going now. Got over the line, but yeah.
And where were you when he told you, or when you found out that it was actually going to go ahead?
So this was all late night. It was midnight sometime, where a bunch of us were all it was all panicky phone calls around of it has to be done by a certain time, and exciting stuff. But
So where does Adelaide fit for you, and where has it fit over this journey? Because we often, people are always quick to knock the city, but I'm interested to know where the opportunities and strengths are that you've found.
I mean, for me, Adelaide, my Adelaide story has been about UniSA, and having a research institute there that actually, was given the latitude and the permission to do large-scale things, and that could maintain a sufficient inertia such that things like Coda and Mariota are kind of the byproducts. And to me, there's a lot of amazing theoretical stuff that comes out of it. I've been involved in some of it, but to me, when I think about when I was director, the things I was most proud about of the institute were exactly the commercial things that came out of it. But that requires a bit of belief. It requires capability and people, and that's where these type of things emerge from.
In these discussions, we always like to sort of take it right back and look at, some of the early stages of your childhood and upbringing, and sort of see where these seeds of business and maths and science have come from. I guess, what was your upbringing like? What was the ingredients involved to then allow you to do what you've done?
It's interesting, because my background, So I'm one of, only a few people in the world who on their birth certificate has occupation of father, puppeteer. true story. So my parents met through puppetry. They're both professional puppeteers at the time they met. And
it's a big industry in Adelaide.
I love the stuff we uncover somehow.
So let's say I didn't come from a science / math engineering.
Not what I pictured.
Background.
Can we get an extra 10 minutes? A few questions we've got.
I do a little puppet show. So I actually grew up as a kid running around every weekend doing puppet shows at kids' birthday parties and so on in the 1970s. Shouldn't have said that, now you know how old I am. It's all lighthearted, but it, for me, it was a contrast that always, interest stirred from the family on more the art side of things, which when I was young, I thought that's what I was going to do. But then got into high school, it's like, I seem to be good at math. I don't know how that happened, but now, with the sort of benefit of hindsight, I look back on some of the things that my father was doing, who actually never even had a high school education, that he was doing things in his life with his sort of craft and so on, that I could say, okay, if this guy had had the opportunity, he would have been an engineer, which is actually interesting. So, you know, my background, fairly rough area down south, from a suburb that actually had to change its name to sort of distance itself from its past, and went to a high school that, through the Tall Poppy program, went back to sometime later to give a talk about...
What high school is that?
Christie's Beach High School.
I'm a high school boy as well, okay, so yeah. Andrew's more of your private school ilk, nah. So...
Yeah, right.
Say good art college, mate. That's cool. We're battlers.
So finding out that that school could no longer offer senior maths, for example, was kind of confronting, and you realise, okay, you've kind of gone through in a, through some kind of weird eye of the needle to then get an interest in electronics kind of late in high school. Engineering, maybe I'll give that a go, and then kind of race sort of on from there.
In those early years, was there like a pivotal interaction or moment with technology that really stood out or inspired you?
I think, it was from that early time of, for me, it was a bit of mucking around with electronics, and then it was the first computer bought from the proceeds of doing the paper route. Mm. Which was actually, my friends had computers that they were playing games on, and by computers, you'll appreciate with the 1970s context, it was like computers. Very quickly going from the games thing to making these do something, becoming very interesting. Mm. And then for me, I think the pivotal moment was during university, actually late high school and university, of actually getting involved in software development for the Angle Park Computing Centre. And I don't know if anyone knows what that is, but it was something run by the South Australian Department of Education to produce educational software. And so for me, summer jobs doing software development as a kid, they're sort of connected the thing very early on of doing some kind of original development or something that then had an outlet.
That's awesome. Now, Andrew, you'll be disappointed. Look, we are going to finish. I've got 30 seconds of rapid-fire questions. So to be true to our podcast, we always sort of finish with this little segment. Completely unscripted, and Andrew Montes is terrible at this.
It's called shit.
So if you see him hesitate or kind of miss your mark, then you'll know why. This may or may not have anything to do with what we've just discussed, but I'm just going to start firing a couple of questions at you. You mentioned art. A one sculpture or painting or, a building that you want to see in real life that you haven't.
Oh, wow. Machu Picchu. Mm.
The one piece of advice you would pass on to a would-be founder?
People are the most important thing. Back yourself and don't be afraid. That's three pieces of advice.
Beautiful. Your favourite puppet?
So my favourite puppet is Pinky, who was this very cheeky pink rabbit that was part of our show.
If you weren't in tech, what would you be doing?
If I wasn't in tech, I think I'd be probably into some kind of graphic production of some kind.
What sort of car do you drive?
Nissan X-Trail.
We should probably wind up, mate.
Okay, we're getting the wind up.
It's fine. We got the wind up about
what next?
Dr. Alex Grant, look, thank you for allowing us to shine a light in your extensive set of achievements. I know we could have kept going for another hour or so, but to condense it to 30 minutes and be so honest and open with your journey has been a great privilege. So put your hands together for Dr. Alex Grant.
Thanks for listening to Rooster Radio, where we talk to interesting people doing amazing things. This interview was recorded live from South Start 2017. Don't miss out on this conference next year. Check out southstart.co for more info. Sign up to our mailing list and listen to more Rooster Radio episodes at roosterradio.biz. And if you like what we're doing, please leave us a review on iTunes.